got a container on site, two containers on site full of district files right now. And so there was the intent.
Good evening. Is it on? And welcome to the March 2020 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. The meeting will come to order. And we will first ask for public comment from many of those in the audience wishing to speak on things of interest to the Health Commission, but things that are not on our regular scheduled agenda for this evening. If there is anyone wishing to make public comment, please come forward. Seeing none of you running up to the podium here to make public comment, we will go ahead and start with our regular agenda for the evening. The first thing will be our consent items. We have two things on the consent items for this evening. Approval of the minutes from our last meeting, which was January of 2020, because we did not have a February 2020 meeting. And also 3.2 item is approval of the Health Commission member appointment that we will submit to the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. Commissioner Cochran is eligible to move up to one of the direct provider seats, and so we'll be moving her up there. So any discussion about any of the consent items? I'll entertain a motion to accept the consent items. Okay, Jean moved.
Second.
Second by Candace. Any other discussion before we vote? If not, all those in favor of accepting our consent items, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Accepted. Next item on the agenda is informational updates on some of the topics that we've already had this year. We have just a couple of updates to report this evening. I think it was September or October meeting. You'll recall we had the health professions class from Paso Robles High School here to give their presentation of the Skills USA winning presentation that they made. I do have a request from that class for one or two of the commissioners, if anybody is interested, to participate and be a judge, if you will, or to hear out. They're doing their mock interviews for professional jobs, which is April the 2nd. There's a morning session and an afternoon session. If anybody can help out with sitting through those interviews, please send me a quick email, and I will forward it on to Ms. LaMandola, who's the instructor there. I'm going to do, I think, the morning session, but they do have a number of kids that will be going through that this year, so they can take a couple of other interviewers if some of you would like to volunteer. And then secondly, since last we met, our County Board of Supervisors have approved the two ordinances that they were considering relating to the sale of tobacco. The first ordinance does prohibit the sale of tobacco products in our unincorporated areas of the county. I should say e-cigarettes in the unincorporated areas of our county. We also, as you recall, sent a letter of support to the city of Morro Bay for the ordinance that they were considering. They've had public input and testimony on that a second time, and they are continuing to work on their ordinance. Commissioner Campbell has been very helpful in doing testimony at the city council meetings and keeping us updated on that. And that's all I have for updates. If any of the rest of you have any quick updates, we can entertain them. Dr. Bornstein will be hopefully joining us a little later this evening, and she'll bring us up to date on what public health has been doing for the last couple of weeks. So with that, let's go ahead and move into our presentations for the evening. I'll ask Commissioner Kleiman to introduce our first speaker.
Tonight we have Tracy Retreif. She's the Executive Director from the California Alliance for Prevention Funding. She's going to be speaking about the new prevention model and the California Wellness Trust. Tracy.
Speak. There we go. Hi, good evening. Thanks for having me. I've been talking to Amy and working with her, and I've met some of the other members here. And I'm here to talk about a California Wellness Trust. And this is a new idea to address the age-old problem of insufficient funding for prevention. We throw all of our dollars into health care, and that's important. We all need health care. But what we neglect to do is to prevent people from needing health care in the first place. So that's what I'll be talking about today. I know that you're health professionals, and so I'm not going to spend too much time over the leading causes of death and illness in California in 2010. They're chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, asthma. And these are the risk factors. Poor diet, which is now the leading risk factor for death in the U.S., yet access to fruits and vegetables has declined nationally. Lack of physical activity is another risk factor, yet the percentage of Californians who feel safe in their neighborhoods has declined. Lack of physical activity, again, a risk factor. Childhood fitness levels have declined, and adult fitness levels have not improved, despite everything we know. Nicotine, risk factor, congratulations. You just banned the sale of electronic smoking devices, and that's part of the bad news, is that California high school students are using them, and they love the flavors. In older adults, this is a population that's growing in California. There's been a huge increase in Alzheimer's death, visits to the ER for falls. And yet, funding for public health programs, hi, Penny, is inversely proportional to the risk of death from those very programs. So you see down at the bottom at the big font, food safety, tuberculosis, we've invested in those, and those investments have worked. There's sustained money for food safety, and by and large, our food is safe. TB rates are low, and they've stayed low, but as you go up the chain into the smaller font, we haven't provided that same level of investment. And even less funding is available to address health inequities. You can see the California death rate, diabetes death rates on the right. And really, what's leading to those are poor food environments, targeted junk food marketing, and other aspects of the environment that are beyond any individual's control. So this is what we like to call the federal funding graveyard of good ideas. You may be familiar with this in SLO. I know that Penny is. I can tell from the look on your face. What these are is these were federal grants. Many of them were funded by the ACA. The applications were tremendously complicated. Only a handful were dispersed. And even if you won one, the funding was pulled after 2 years. The result is that even the best ideas are constrained to scale. You're probably familiar with a program in your community, whether it's an after-school program, a nonprofit program. Everybody loved it. It was showing great results. And yet it couldn't expand to the whole school district. It couldn't expand to the whole county because it was funded by grants. And many programs just stop and die altogether as a result of this stop-and-go siloed funding. This has an impact on people. We have millions who are dying and disabled by diseases that we know how to prevent. Has an impact on healthcare costs. Over $800 million in SLO in 2010, about $3,000 per resident. The six leading costs in California generated over the six leading diseases in California generated over $367 billion in treatment costs in 2016. Has an impact on business. Lower productivity, lost workdays, well over $100 billion a year. This number is from 2006. It's the most recent data we can find. Imagine what that is today. And these are costs associated with lifestyle risks. And if you what you can see here is that in every age group, as the number of risk for chronic disease increases, the cost for care increases. That's from people who are between 19 and 34 years old all the way up to seniors. Spending associated with diabetes and other disorders has more than doubled since 1996, with diabetes being the most tremendous increase, 321% between 1996 and 2015. So it's time for a change. I think much of what I've just told you, you already knew, but I like to just sort of lay it out to refresh us all about the crisis. The California Alliance for Prevention Funding is a coalition of 20 organizations that came together to address this issue. So you'll probably recognize many of the statewide nonprofits, American Heart, American Lung, and then there's organizations that represent local governments, such as the Health Officers Association of California, the County Health Executives Association of California. So it's a balance of about half nonprofits, half organizations that represent local health departments. And this is the challenge that they've convened to address, creating a sustainable flow of funding to prevent chronic disease and injury in California. We think one solution is creating what we're calling a California Wellness Trust. And we've written a proposal because this is a big idea. And we knew we needed to put it in writing in order for people to take it seriously, in order to get feedback on it, and to be able to show that this is something that we could do. So the proposal includes a purpose, and this is to assure dedicated funding of programs that address these diseases. The proposal includes strategies that would be funded, and because today's public health problems have underlying causes in common, funding will focus on shared solutions. And what you see there on the screen are examples of strategies that could be funded. Many of them are upstream strategies. Health education is important. But we're looking at going far beyond health education to addressing the social and environmental determinants of health. Funds should be distributed and coordinated among community-based organizations, local health departments, state government. Should reach every California county with a focus on the most under-resourced. Must benefit all Californians across age groups, urban to rural, and across California's diverse races and ethnicities. We have a proposed governance structure. There would be an oversight committee with members who have expertise and experience in equity and prevention appointed by the governor and the legislature to advise the state on priorities for and administration of the fund. If you're familiar with how tobacco funds are administered at the state, it's a very similar model. And the committee would document progress. There would be some robust assessment of progress and indicators. We're calling for an investment of at least $10 per person, which is less than 1/1,000th of what we spent on healthcare in 2018. We think that's reasonable. And this is how we propose funding would be allocated. And this is based on $400 million total. So that would be $10 per capita in California. We're proposing 45% go to local health departments as a direct allocation with a fixed floor of $250K. So Alpine gets $250K and Los Angeles gets $250K. The remainder of the funds in that pot are divided up according to a formula based half on population, half on poverty. 40% would go to nonprofits, 30% to local, 10% to regional nonprofits, and those would be through competitive grants awarded by the state entity. There's a carve-out for regional and state nonprofits because we heard from many partners in rural areas that there was a very thin net of nonprofits in their region. And so they would welcome the assistance from a state or a regional nonprofit that could go to their area, work with local leaders, and seed and grow the nonprofit sector. And then there'd be 15% to the California Department of Public Health to do what they do best around media campaigns, epidemiologic surveillance, as well as to administer. So we have two revenue options, and we have just come up with a short-term revenue option, and this is really exciting. What we did was I've been traveling around the state, talking to groups from Humboldt to Riverside and everywhere in between, presenting our proposal, getting feedback, and picking up endorsements for it. So we now have over 50 organizations that have endorsed the concept, and I'll get to that a bit later. But what we've done is we took these endorsements to Sacramento, and we spoke with members of the administration, and we said, look who supports us. This is what we want to do. What's your feedback? Well, they absolutely agree with the idea. And they said, listen, this is huge. Why don't you start with a pilot? We have a $7 billion surplus this year. Do a request from the general fund in a number of counties across California. Document that it works. Build excitement. Build your base. And then come back. So that's what we're doing. The Public Health Institute and HOAC, that's the Health Officers Association of California, are co-sponsoring this budget request. It's a one-time request for $180 million over 5 years to prevent the leading causes of illness, injury, and death, such as heart disease, diabetes, and dementia. We named three diseases we were advised by Senator Pan to sort of hone in. Now, those of us in public health know you could put any three diseases up there, and when you're focusing on your strategies, you're going to reach them all. 2/3 of funds will support strategies to reduce risks, and we've listed three strategies here: improving access to healthy food and drinking water, increasing opportunities to be physically active, and promoting safer neighborhoods and healthy community environments. What we're trying to do there is hit the sweet spot between specificity and giving local health departments and nonprofits the latitude that they need to address local risk factors. 1/3 of the funds may be used to implement other strategies that are determined by communities and their needs assessments to achieve the overarching goal. And so one of the things I'm here to ask you for today is a letter of support for this budget request. It would mean a lot coming from SLO. We already have a number of endorsements, thanks to Penny and other supporters here who have really worked in this region and advocated for this idea. Now we have some long-term revenue options. We contracted with a legal public health law and policy firm, and they identified taxes on one or more healthy products such as sodas or alcohol as one of the best funding sources for a California wellness trust. Those are heavy lifts. We haven't abandoned that, and we're still working toward the long term. But in the meanwhile, we're going to get this up and running with this budget request. That's the idea. So it's a fair question. Is this feasible? I mean, it's a big idea. And the good news is it's already happening in three other states. Oklahoma has the best model. They invested all of their tobacco master settlement funds in an endowment from the get-go that's generating millions of dollars for prevention every year. Minnesota and Massachusetts funded their wellness trust through assessments on hospitals and insurers. All of them are showing tremendous results, and I do have materials here, and we have a one-pager that has more information about those three models. So this is what we plan to do over the next 2 years. We're advocating for the budget request from the general fund. We're building a statewide movement for the sustained end goal of investment for every California county in prevention and health equity. We're actively researching additional funding sources, and we're tracking potential legislative or ballot initiatives that we might latch on to. And this is how a California wellness fund could benefit payers and providers. When I looked at the background of the members of the commission today, I saw that this that we did have some providers here. And so a California wellness trust can reduce expenditures for all patients, including those with high needs. And I know that that has been a focus of a number of statewide programs over the past several years. Can improve HEDIS quality measures by investing in social determinants. Increase employee productivity like it can for every business by reducing absenteeism and reduce health insurance costs for your workforce. And here's how you could endorse creating a California Wellness Trust. For the budget request, your support will mean everything to see this through. Send letters to Senator Monning. Talk to Senator Monning if you know him. Send letter to the health committee chairs, and I've provided a sample letter in your packet. And if you're in Sacramento, come speak at budget hearings. And you can also take action to support the end goal. You can bring a resolution of support for the concept of creating a California Wellness Trust to your decision makers. And some people ask, why resolve to support a concept? Well, we know this proposal will change as it goes through the political process. The source of funding may change, the way it's governed may change. The essential goal of the proposal to provide sustained funding for upstream prevention in California with a focus on health equity, that is unwavering, and that's what we're asking for support for. Contra Costa, Humboldt, Los Angeles, and Monterey County Boards of Supervisors have already taken action and support this either through their legislative agenda or board orders. We've won endorsements from school districts and school-based programs. You'll see Santa Cruz School District on there very soon, I think. We've won endorsements from numerous nonprofits and other organizations. You'll see several San Luis Obispo organizations there. And here's some resources that we can provide. We have copies of the Wellness Trust proposal. We have model resolutions. I have tons of fact sheets. I have legal considerations report. All of this is available on our website. We can provide speakers. It would probably be me, because I am a one-woman organizing campaign for the state of California, and assistance with media outreach and, you know, just to be a thought partner. Happy, you know, Amy and I have had a number of conversations. Penny and I have had a number of conversations about how to get support in your region and to pull people on board. So thanks. That's the end of my presentation, and I would love to hear your comments, questions.
All right, questions from commissioners, starting to my left.
Great presentation. You're totally preaching to the choir here. It sounds amazing. I guess my question is about the timing.
Yeah.
So the budget request is going forward when? And then if that was approved, then the next steps are activating underneath that. And I'm just wondering how that would work.
Good question. So this budget request is going in, and this would be for the California state budget for 2020 to 2021.
Right.
The governor has already released a budget, and he did that in January. And then there's all kinds of machinations that go on before the May revise. So the way it's happening is that there are health budget committees for health and human services in both the Assembly and the Senate. There's a new rule that you need a champion in the Assembly now, but most Assembly members didn't know that. And so we really, really had to pound the pavement in Sacramento, and Assembly Member Bloom is our champion. And so it's been heard in the Assembly. The Senate budget hearing will take place on April 2nd, and so we would love to have a letter from you into that committee by April 2nd, if possible. After that time, then there's a budget committee that's formed with members of both the Assembly and the Senate budget committees. They sort of get together in a smaller committee. They sift through all the recommendations, and they make the final recommendations to the governor for the May revise.
Great. So then, I'm just trying to think of, like, practicalities.
Yeah.
So let's say all that happens.
Yeah.
Great. And then underneath that, you're trying to get other monies together in order to further support the original allocation. Is that correct?
We're sort of operating on two tracks now. We have the end goal of passing a new tax in the state of California, right, to raise $400 million every year for public health prevention. In the short term, we're asking for $180 million as a one-time ask to be spread over 5 years, mm-hmm, a year of planning, 3 years of implementation, and a year of evaluation.
Got it. That sounds great. I was just looking towards stability as far as people that are getting the money, so that sounds great.
Right. So I mean, you know, we all know how long startup takes. So that's why we're building in a year. $180 million would cover 15% of the population of the state of California, and we have heard advice from people in high places, everything from $400 million down to $5. However, we met with the staffers for the budget committees and presented this, and they thought $180 million wasn't unreasonable.
Great. Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you for a great presentation. My question, and I saw some bits and pieces in there, is as we're looking at whole person care and seeing, I saw substance abuse, mental health, the behavioral health issues mentioned. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's a huge piece that we don't want to leave out, right, particularly substance abuse, because we've got the Mental Health Services Act, which covers
exactly
a lot of money out there.
Yeah.
For mental health. And can you give me any idea on how that's being developed?
Yeah, people do ask about the mental health issue a lot, and there is the MHSA funds, which there's a ton of money, and they've had a hard time getting it out the door, and it's my understanding it's because there's pretty tight restrictions on how it can be spent, and that the Newsom administration is looking at that. I'm not a mental health expert, but that's my understanding of that. In terms of substance abuse, yes, I think that this funding could be used for prevention of substance use. When you're talking about safe and healthy communities, then you're talking about advertising, and you're talking about zoning and density. A lot of the issues that go along with tobacco, at the very least, go along with alcohol. And then when you're talking about the opioid epidemic, I mean, I think that some of the funds would be able to address that because it's an important prevention issue. And as you saw with the distribution of funds, we had two-thirds going to healthy food, physical activity, and healthy and safe neighborhoods, and then one-third that communities could decide how those funds could be spent. So if opioids or other substance abuse was something going on in SLO that you wanted to address, then you'd be able to do that.
I think one of the issues that we're often not looking at, too, is with our seniors and fall prevention.
Absolutely.
And how many times is that connected to alcohol abuse?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe mixing with their medications, too. So.
Absolutely. And you'll notice that we did call out seniors and senior falls because those are preventable, for sure. And those prevention strategies really show a positive return on investment in terms of dollars.
Commissioner Sage, as Commissioner Sage, can I just pipe in too? Thanks. I'm sure that Commissioner Warren knows this because she's very tuned in, but just for the public information regarding the governor's State of the State address included a statement that he expects that MHSA dollars will be made available for substance use along with mental health. And that's not to say that a preventive trust fund, that there isn't more needed always, but I just wanted to make sure that that information was out there.
The money that you're looking at, is it based on county or population? You know, as far as distribution, if this was funded, would you have some way of distributing it?
Is the question
the
around the budget request?
Yeah.
The way the money would be distributed right now, the degree of specificity that we've articulated is that the state would distribute the money, would decide which regions would receive funds. So it wouldn't be every region in California. It would be a region from north, central, south. I mean, it depends on how big the ask is. So there'd be an advisory committee working with the state and some of the criteria that they would use to select regions that would initially receive funding would be indices of the social determinants of health, indices of the rates of chronic disease, and population. Now, the way, I mean, so obviously I get this question a lot, you know, would my region be funded? And I mean, of course, that's an important question. And so that's part of my answer. But really, the way I think about it is that you win either way, because the point of this budget request is to jumpstart funding for the entire state. So we know that there's need everywhere, and you know, hopefully funding would come to your community. It's not sort of strategic politically to name the communities right now, and there would be a process. But by supporting this, I think that really what you're supporting is the bigger end goal as well.
Thank you, Tracy. One of the questions I had was about the pie chart breakdown of how the dollars would be disseminated. One thing that I hear often about this county is that when available grants and funds become available, the smaller counties sort of get forgotten.
Yes.
So it's nice to see that that breakdown is sort of structured in a way that there's weight to some of the other avenues to fund those sources. I'm looking at the breakdown of Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Massachusetts and how they built out their wellness trust. Have they done something similar to a budget request and then sort of developed into a larger long-term goal for revenue? Or was that, I know they're all unique in their own way. One's
right.
A tobacco settlement, another is a sugar tax.
Right.
How did that look?
In Oklahoma, no. I mean, Oklahoma, they just took those master settlement funds and put them into an endowment. In Minnesota, I don't know whether or not they did a budget request. And I do know in Massachusetts, none of them were budget requests from the general fund. They all had outside funding sources. And so the funding sources for Minnesota and Massachusetts were taxes on hospitals and insurers. Minnesota is still going strong, and their wellness trust continues to get funding and to move forward. In Massachusetts, it was just a four-year pilot. It was a one-time assessment, and they were not successful in renewing that assessment and keeping that going, even though they had remarkable results that they were able to demonstrate.
Thank you. And then my second question is really around if you could just reiterate what you're looking for at this stage from us, both for support for a budget request, but also for the long-term revenue goals of setting up that trust.
Thank you. So, yes, we are looking first and foremost for your support for that budget request in the form of a letter to Assemblymember Arambula and Senator Pan. And there's a draft letter that you could use as a reference if you so chose in your packet. So that's one. And two, an endorsement for the concept, an endorsement for that end goal. So you saw all the organizations that I showed up on the screen, all the organizations, boards of supervisors, school districts that have endorsed. I would love to include the San Luis Obispo Health Commission there. Every name from every geography, from every sector, I mean, showing that broad support is what's going to move this forward.
This is marvelously ambitious.
Indeed.
and it's so needed. I don't have a question, but if it's possible, could we see that one slide that showed deaths from diabetes broken down by ethnic groups?
Yeah. I can see you looking for it here.
It's right there, Mike, I think.
Yeah, that's it.
No, it was a bar chart, a vertical bar chart.
Here we go.
There. That's astonishing.
It's astonishing. And when you look, I don't have the exact figures, but there are exact figures about how many more advertisements for junk food children of color see compared to white children. And when you look at the images that soda companies and cereal companies and tobacco companies and vaping companies all and alcohol, they're all targeting low-income communities, vulnerable residents. And when you look at health inequities, you're looking at people who have lived in neighborhoods where there are historical years and years of disinvestment. There aren't grocery stores there, and it becomes this self-perpetuating cycle. There aren't grocery stores there. Low-income people live there. It's not safe. Grocery stores don't want to locate there. There's not enough, enough revenue to support a grocery store, to support a bike path, to make everyday physical activity something that's possible. I mean, in slow, I've been here for a day and a half. I've walked several miles. I love this place, right? It's safe. I feel good. I walked home at night from, what's it called, the Big Sky Cafe? Great restaurant. and it feels good to walk around. I know you have your farmers markets on Thursdays, but a lot of communities, you don't want to leave the house, you have to get in your car and to drive someplace else. So those are some of the things that contribute to this tremendous and reversible inequity.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Susan.
Yeah. Do you have, I didn't see all the endorsements. Do you have the endorsements of like First Five and Head Start?
We have the endorsement from First Five in San Luis Obispo. We do not have an endorsement from Head Start. I haven't gotten there yet. I mean, I myself am funded by grants and Stop and Go funding. But we were just renewed. We now have 2.5 years of renewed funding, and they gave us more than they did initially because they can see the momentum we have. And what we're stepping up is we're stepping up our communications and social media, and we're going to step up our grassroots efforts.
So thank you, Tracy. I think in San Luis, you have the endorsement from our YMCA.
Yes.
SenCal. Who's our big Medi-Cal initiative pair, and California First Five. And commissioners, you'll notice that we do have an agenda item later this evening, which is a letter of support for the budget proposal. And if somebody wants to agendize a discussion about a resolution to support the entire concept, we can get that on the agenda for some time as well. So thank you for heading south once again to talk to us. We appreciate you being here with us this evening. And please stay for the rest of our meeting if you would like.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Great questions and great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. And now I will ask Commissioner Raymond to introduce our other speakers for this evening.
We have two speakers this evening that will be discussing the chronic disease and transitions of care. And we're going to be starting with Tina McAvoy, and she is a nurse, a care coordinator for transition and palliative care programs. It's kind of a big hat she wears, and she's with Dignity Health. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I could speak for many hours about all the post-acute care programs that are at Dignity, but I know that I've only been given a few minutes. So I've tried to narrow it down to our care transitions and our outpatient palliative care program. I am the care coordinator for multiple programs in the Northern Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County. So for this commission, I'm going to focus primarily on our Arroyo Grande Hospital service area and French Hospital. But as you can see, we've got service area, we've got hospice and home care, inpatient rehab, skilled nursing facility throughout the entire area. And those programs I'm not going to speak to tonight. The Care Transitions Program used to be called Heart Failure Program, but we've evolved because we, as Tracy pointed out, there are so many chronic diseases that we are now looking at any kind of a chronic illness that requires the attention of our nurse, our care coordinator, our navigators to help them transition from the inpatient unit to home. So our care transitions program is all cause now, and we really look at the high risk of patients. And our goal is to get them, I don't know if you can hear me, get them at the right level of care at the right time and in the right location. Because we're part of a health system, we're able to have a warm handoff between settings. And we want to be able to have that continuum of care. We've also been able to gather data that does demonstrate that when we are providing this care transitions care, that our readmission rates and use of emergency rooms decreases, which is very beneficial to the hospitals. Our overarching care transition program has the telephonic support, which is the care transition nurse navigator. We've got diabetes management. We've now got a family caregiver program, and the CBPC is our community-based palliative care. So all those are part of our care transitions program. These are also all programs that are provided by our community benefit department. We don't charge or bill for most any of these services. And I'll get a little bit more specific as I get to each particular program. Our care transition partners are our home health agencies, our palliative care, our cancer programs here at Hearst Cancer Resource Center, as well as Mission Hope, our community benefits department, our diabetes. We work very closely with the Promotora Network in our community, our cardiac rehab programs, our skilled nursing facility, and then all the Pacific Health clinics that are part of Dignity, and as well as all the internal and care managers. So all these people are sources of referrals, and we're able to move patients back and forth to what will help them the most. So what do we do? The nurse is going to be calling, and we are going to focus on symptoms. We look at their function. We look at the support. If they are on, if they're discharged from the hospital and they go home with home health care, they do get a discharge call from a nurse the care transition program is not going to duplicate what is done by home health. But if home health does not go out for any particular reason, we're notified, and then our care transitions program will pick that patient up. We focus on disease management, education, and we really want to promote self-care. We are helping to make sure that they have their follow-up physician appointments, and it is self-reported, but we do go over medications. We do medication reconciliation from the discharge forms, because we have access to the chart, and making sure that they have the medication that they picked up. And it always feels really excellent when you make a save. An example is a COPD or lung patient went home, and he lived with his mother. Excuse me, he lived separate but near his mother, and he had not yet picked up his medication. He said, I went to Walgreens and it's not there. Well, I was able to look in the chart. It's because it's at Walmart. So you can help make those corrections and get them the medications that they need. In addition, we can also help access funds if they can't pay for their medications. We can connect them with the Alliance for Pharmaceutical Access, or we can also access some funds that are available from our hospital care coordinators that we can just pay and get them on the APA afterwards. We work very closely to make sure that they have their physician appointment. Sometimes, because of the shortage of physicians, even people who are discharged that have had a sepsis diagnosis, sometimes they can't get an appointment very quickly. So out of French Hospital, as well as all the hospitals, we have worked up a system where they can be seen by one of the transitional care physicians out of the clinics as a stopgap, and that person, that physician, will then notify their own physician. We're not trying to steal that patient from the clinic, but we're just trying to make sure that some people are seen. We work very closely with the SenCal, because sometimes it's access and transportation, so we make sure that they can get to their appointments. We do, you guys have some handouts. We use the zones, the red, yellow, green, with our patients. All this is also in Spanish, and we do have a bilingual nurse who can call all of our Spanish patients to make sure that they don't have any questions. We make referrals to home care, cardiac rehab, palliative care, or any other program that they might be eligible for. Sometimes patients will say, no, I don't need something. They think they're going to just do fine at home. No, I don't need home health. And then when they get home, they've spent a night, and it's like they change their mind. So we're able to get those orders going again. I already talked about other access. Sometimes it's basic needs, such as shelter, food, housing. So we have a social worker that we work with. We work with Catholic Charities, any of our nonprofits, to try to get food and monies available. We also help with supplies and equipment and transportation. Some of the innovations in our care transitions program, we work very closely with at French Hospital with Dr. Mike Ryan, and he is a pulmonary arterial hypertension clinic, and we now got recertified as a regional center of excellence. So our care transition nurses work with his patients and do the follow-up, and it's been very successful, and it's exciting to know that we now have a regional center of excellence here on the Central Coast. We've also worked with the Santa Barbara Foundation on our caregiver initiative, which I'll get to, and we have dedicated RN staff now calling all discharge patients for all three hospitals. most of our patients. We used to keep patients on for 90 days, but we found we didn't really need to do that. And we are keeping most of our patients on our service for about 30 days to 60 days, depending on their needs. Sometimes they opt out. They're tired of talking to the nurse or reviewing meds. But we really do focus on education and getting them to be self-sufficient. We'll also stop them if they are now starting cardiac rehab or any other outpatient program. Many times they move or they are transferred to hospice or palliative care. And once in a while, they'll end up back in the hospital and not make it back out. Our diabetes and wellness, we have two different programs because out of Arroyo Grande, which is part of Marion, we do have the diabetes wellness education. And that does require a physician's order. We've got dietitian and we've got a diabetic education nurse who works one-on-one with patients. In addition, they do a series of classes and try to get those patients very tuned in to what's important for their needs. Out of French, the dietitian meets with patients, and then there's a very active support group. In addition, through our community benefits department, there are a series of, it's called DEEP, so it's, Diabetic Education Empowerment Program. And it's in Spanish and English, and it is a six-week course, and it is for patients to learn how to control their diabetes, and it is a little bit more global, so it's not in place of the one-on-one, but it is to help with their needs, and they invite their caregivers to come as well, so they get a lot of education, and those are actually very vibrant, enjoyable courses, and they're provided free of charge throughout the entire service area in both Spanish and English. In addition, there are support groups for diabetes in English and Spanish. I put up there the CDSMP, and that's the Chronic Disease Self-Management Program, which is also a part of the community benefit in English and Spanish, which is provided throughout our entire service area. And that's for anyone with a chronic disease to learn how to better manage their illness and self-care. This just shows that for the diabetes wellness, we do require a physician's order. There are certain criteria that must be met for services. They will bill insurances, but we provide a lot of this education free of charge if the insurance doesn't cover it or if the copay is too high. It goes through our community benefits department, so the patient does not have to pay out of pocket. I already went over that. Our community-based palliative care is also a relatively new program. We got certified and accredited by Joint Commission in July of 2018. So we have been working for almost 2 years. I can't believe it. And we're very proud because it is a very important program to provide because not everybody wants to go on hospice. I worked for 30 years in hospice, and I love hospice, but not everybody's ready. And with many of the cancer drugs that require ongoing immunotherapy, they can't be on hospice with immunotherapy. I won't say they can't, but it's cost prohibitive for the hospice programs to pay for some of these medications. So palliative care is able to come on out. In addition, palliative care is provided. We are part of the home health agency, but we are not dependent on a patient being homebound. So in home health care, though they provide fabulous work, whether it's nursing or therapy, the patient has to be homebound. And there are so many patients that fall through those cracks that are not really homebound, but have a serious health situation. And so palliative care can go on out. It is not just for people who are imminently dying. We look at their symptoms and we really try to get them feeling well so they don't need us. We make home visits. We've got an interdisciplinary team and we have team meetings, and we will see the patient and then discharge them when either they transition to another level of care, or we love it when we are able to discharge patients because their goals have been met and they just don't need us anymore. That's a good thing. We coordinate with all the other healthcare providers, including all the cancer centers. We'll make home visits as well as clinic visits to kind of make sure that everybody's on the same page. Dr. Matt Cadix is our medical director. We now have a nurse practitioner, and then I'm one of the palliative care nurses, as well as the coordinator, and we have a social worker and a chaplain. The other program, which is primarily started out of our Santa Barbara County through the Santa Barbara Foundation, is a family caregiver program. But we have now come up into San Luis Obispo, and we come as high as Avila right now. And this was one of those grant-funded programs that our hospitals have identified as being so important that we are now sustaining it. I suppose we're almost 75% supported by our hospital, and it's out of, again, our community benefit department. This is where we focus on the caregiver. And this is not for the short-term caregivers. This is for the long-term caregivers, especially those that provide care to dementia or Alzheimer's patient. And what we do is we have a licensed clinical social worker go out to the home, meet with the caregiver, give them a basket of goodies, not the patient. The patient will end up benefiting from the support. They do counseling. They connect them with resources that the patient may be eligible for, respite services. We teach a powerful tools for caregiver course where they will come and learn tools on how to put the oxygen on them before they take care of their patient, their loved one. And then we link to all sorts of different providers. We also work again very closely with the Promotores Network, and they go with the licensed clinical social worker, and we also provided a training so that they could do their own powerful tools for caregiver course in Spanish. It has been a labor of love, and the San Luis Obispo County's been asking for it. So now we are in San Luis Obispo County, and we hope to be able to go all the way up the coast. The nice thing is we don't need a doctor's order for it. It's awesome. And there's initial visits and telephonic support. And what we've been able to do is we've also been able to gather statistics and data that demonstrates that 6 months prior to our intervention and 6 months after, that we've been able to decrease significantly by 25% to 35% of hospital visits and emergency room visits. Now, I'm not a statistician, but we're still very happy with that. So we've also been able to identify that the caregiver is able to verbally report a burden risk and improve self-care of the caregiver. And that is it in a nutshell. I kind of went fast and it's a lot of information. So if you have any questions.
a lot of services there. Questions from the commissioners. Candace.
Thank you so much. Let me see if I understand this right with respect to how people get enrolled in your program. So is it all coming out of the hospitals?
We get a number of our referrals from the hospital. We get them from doctor's offices. Okay. We get them from home health. We get them from people who've heard about it, like especially with the family caregiver, friends of friends of friends, they call in. Diabetes, same thing. So if there is one of the programs that requires a physician's order, we don't care how we get the referral. We'll follow up and then get what we need.
Great. And it sounds like you have so many different things going on, so you probably know a lot about what's happening in our community. I wonder if you could speak to what you've seen are barriers for you. What do you wish you had more of, or are there people that you wish you could serve more? Or
well, one of the barriers is volunteers. Mm-hmm. So we have, with our caregiver program, we try to provide volunteers to sit with the person who has, especially for dementia. But there's a lot of volunteers working, and I mean, there's a lot of nonprofits, and there's like, what do you call it? It's volunteer fatigue. So we could use more volunteers, and I think access to hired caregivers, that's also an issue. Because there's a lot of people who they're trying to save for a rainy day, and then that rainy day comes and they're afraid to spend their money, or they actually don't have as much as they thought, because hiring care for people at, especially towards end of life, is very expensive. Medications, diabetes medication. I mean, there's a lot of barriers mm-hmm. in our health system. Mm-hmm. And I know our diabetic educator is working all the time trying to help people get their insulin because it's so expensive.
Right.
So,
do your volunteers require special training?
We do train them, mm-hmm. and they do have to pass a background check.
Okay. So I do teach at Cal Poly, so I have a rich source of really excited, usually,
I'll
undergraduate
send you
students.
Something.
So, yes, we should get in contact.
Wonderful. Because we can also give internship-type information, or, you know, get them whatever it is they need. We can help make that happen.
Sometimes they like senior project credit. Sometimes mm-hmm. they like the hours to be documented. It depends.
Yes, we can do all that.
Excellent.
Down this way, questions. Amy?
Hi, Tina. Thank
Hi.
You. The DEEP program and the CDSMP program, I used to work for People's Self-Help Housing, and we used to coordinate with Patty Herrera to bring
yes.
those classes out to the community, and I can provide testimony that those reduce barriers dramatically when you embed them directly in the community and put them in places where people can take direct advantage of them outside of work hours in a space where they're comfortable. So thank you for doing that. And I now work for the American Diabetes Association, so I'm happy to see these standards of care trickling down here.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank
right,
you for
thank
great
you
presentation
very much.
And telling us what you do. Jean?
I'm supposed to do that.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Kevin Parsich, and he's the Chief Medical Officer at Wilshire Health and Community Services, and he'll be speaking about an overview of chronic disease management, some of the programs. Wilshire has a number of programs as well, not just Dignity. Wilshire has them as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jean. Should I be at the mic? I tend to talk loud anyways. Good evening, and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you all. As noted, I am the Chief Medical Officer of Wilshire, and I'm a family doc by training, but for the past 7-8 years, I've been focusing on only geriatrics and palliative care. And so from going from literally cradle to grave and doing a ton of pediatrics to now focusing on senior care, it's been very, very enlightening about what I'm seeing as kind of a, not to be dramatic about it, but sort of a growing crisis that nobody's talking about, and that is aging. You know, we get perseverative sometimes about our homeless issues and our opioid crisis and COVID-19s, but this is steadily growing rapidly. And so I want to take this in a little bit of a different direction. I don't want to just teach you a little bit about Wilshire, which I'll get to, but I think it's worth talking a little bit about the generalities, because much of what I want to speak to is equal with exactly what Tracy is presenting, what Tina's representing, and that is those of us in healthcare. Gene, you know this very well, and I know that. Those of us in healthcare recognize that we need to all band together and come up with a solution before it's too late. So, on that note, recognizing that we have 10,000 baby boomers a day turning 65, entering the Medicare pool. A day. That is a lot of people to take care of, right? 2020 will be the first time in American history where there'll be more people over 65 than under 5. It's outrageous. And then these stats speak for themselves, and those of us in the industry know it, that 80% of the dollars we spend are on 20% or less, and most of that is in the last 16, 18 months, and really the lion's share is in the last 6 months of life. Which is, again, something that isn't being talked about or addressed. So, and then this speaks for itself as well. What did we do to increase life expectancy? Obviously, we're better at what we do with everything. So, moving on quickly, because I don't want to waste a lot of time for you folks, but it is worth noting what exactly are the issues, because they are so multifactorial and they touch across the full spectrum. For example, the physical health, we can talk about chronic disease transitions till the day, you know, till the cows come home. But the truth is, we have a shortage of primary care. We don't have enough docs to take care of people through primary care sources. Cognitive health. We have more and more people getting older and older, but the stats are saying that over the age of 85, you've got 50% with significant dementia and cognitive decline without the resources to deal with that. Mental health, huge issue with the younger population, but also in the elderly. Again, not being addressed. Do you realize that most psychiatrists are not willing to bill Medicare? So people are paying cash, and the psychiatrists are willing to bill at whatever rate they want. So now you've got, 20% of suicides in the elderly? And who would have known that? So again, another issue that needs to be dealt with, malnutrition. I see a lot of it. Now that I'm doing more and more in the homes and in assisted living facilities, and we're seeing more and more problems with malnutrition. People can't afford the groceries, or they have limited access to them, or they have cognitive loss, or they have some barrier that's preventing them from just eating well. And we're not just talking fruits and veggies and preventive medicine. We're just talking food. Yeah. Housing, major issue. We talk about it through the spectrum, right? But what do you do with two 85-year-olds who can barely scrape it by, who can't afford to even pay their property taxes anymore, or who can no longer stay safely? They can't afford to fix the roof over their head, or they don't have the cognitive abilities to figure out how to maintain the home. So housing has become a major issue. In fact, we just heard a speech by the lady that runs the Prado Road. What's the Capslow? Capslow. And they have an over 80%, was it, Ron? 80% increase? 60% increase in the number of people entering the homeless shelter over the age of 65. Unbelievable. Drugs speak for themselves as well. The cost of medications are ridiculous. We already know that more than 50% of prescriptions don't even get filled. Of those that are filled, more than like a third to 50% of those are not being taken correctly, leading to side effects, leading to all kinds of problems. Then entering the realm of substance abuse. That stat about 5 million in the U.S. is old numbers, years and years old. And this is elderly of 5 million with substance abuse issues. And then the biggest one, the number one killer of elderly, I heard this in a lecture recently, the number one killer is loneliness. People become isolated. It leans to the mental health, but it's beyond that. It's about the socialization. It's about the limited access and support. We can build support services till we're all clawing all over each other with stuff to do good for people, but they don't know what's out there and they don't know how to figure it out. Most of them don't know how to Google. Right? So as we look at programs like what Tracy's trying to build, which is spectacular, we need to look at it from their angle, right? Not just what do we think that they need, but how are we going to infiltrate into the world of aging and really develop a successful program, looking at some of these barriers. So that was my soapbox. Thank you for that. So transitioning a chronic disease patient, That's the biggest thing for you to know. We have lots of programs between Dignity and us and Central Coast and other outpatient-based facilities. But the truth is, unless we're doing a comprehensive care management, and then if we don't have the access availability to those resources, then the rest is a moot point, right? We need, and once we integrate into the aging and the high-risk people, we need to be able to develop at all of those levels, because I can prescribe 10 different medications, but if they can't even drive to the pharmacy to get it, who cares, right? So we need to look at all of those different levels, like the list that I have up there. You know, remote patient monitoring is referring to telemedicine. You know, that's a big buzzword right now. Everyone's talking about telemedicine. Right now, there are still significant barriers to even being able to use it. They're trying to reimburse a little bit more, but for most people, telemedicine is still a pipe dream, and then you hope to have a grant or a large company like Dignity, you know, a part of a large conglomerate that can really pay for and subsidize a program like that. But for most small people, utilizing telemedicine is still years away in terms of a really definitive application. So, Wilshire, now I'll go on to that. What do we do? So, we've been around a long time, back to 1947. My understanding, because I wasn't around then, is that the county actually started Wilshire as a county home health agency, home health and hospice, and that kind of did its thing for a while, and then Wilshire is a company out of LA that came in as a nonprofit and helped take that over from the county and keep it running. So we have a long, long history. We were built by the county to support the county, and that's what we continue to do today. At the core, we're a hospice or home health agencies, as well as a large division of community services that are all free to the public. And then who we serve, we're mostly doing senior care, senior-related care, but it's literally everyone above the pediatric age. So home health. Now, I'm going to speak a little bit to the specifics, because we throw these around, but, I mean, other than Gene, I don't know who else is a medical person. So forgive me if some of this is redundant or you don't understand it, but I think it's worth you recognizing how that fits into the spectrum of care that we provide in terms of resources for people. So home health is a benefit that Medicare pays for. Most other insurance agencies will pay for them. And it's literally for anyone who is considered homebound. Now, what does homebound mean? Literally, it could mean a taxing effort to leave the home. Okay. Typically, it's somebody who just came out of the hospital or somebody who's just had surgery, but it can be the frail 87-year-old lady who can no longer get to the grocery store and who has to get a rideshare to be able to come to even to her doctor's appointments. One of the things I recognize is that we in the medical community, we physicians, are not trained in any way, shape, or form how to maximize the use of this for our own patients. I didn't even understand how to use it till I became a full-time home health and hospice physician about how it's underutilized. And some of that is because of all the levels of care that we provide are so substantial that we docs assume that it's just being done at the hospital or somewhere else. But if you look at the litany of services that are provided, you might know this already, and forgive me if it's redundant for you, but this is the full spectrum level of care that people need. You've got the social workers and the dietitians. It's all being directed by a physician as well as an RN who's going into the home. So where the rubber meets the road is exactly that. You enter the home. So you're seeing what they're eating. You're seeing how they're living. You're seeing the issues about fall risk. Whoever brought that up? That's Tina. Tracy, thank you. The fall risk is a major issue, but if you're not in the home, you can't see any of that. And I recognize now that when I was a primary care physician in my brick-and-mortar practice, seeing patients and feeling like I was doing great for them, probably I didn't have a clue what their lives were really like or what I was prescribing for or not. This isn't the extension of me. So home health needs to be something that you think about in terms of an applicable tool towards extending in those care transitions towards chronic disease management. This is going to be the tip of the spear. Okay? Hospice is basically the next level of home health. It's when somebody's got 6 months or less to live, and you get the same sort of full spectrum. So a lot of people think hospice is really just about the last couple of days. You're coming out of the hospital and you're literally, you know, transitioning and you have days to live, and that's not necessarily true. What we recognize now is it's a benefit that it can extend indefinitely as long as a physician is saying that you've got 6 months or less to live. So end-stage heart failure. end-stage dementia patients. It isn't just terminal cancers anymore. And the beauty is that studies over and over prove that people live longer when they're on hospice because of the full spectrum of care. Again, it's like home health. You've got people in there going through, helping them with their finances, helping them with the end-of-life planning issues, helping deal with the estranged son from Chicago who keeps calling and getting mom all riled up. You know, it's that level of care. Prescriptions are dealt with in real time. Symptoms are managed. So again, it's another one of those tools that can be very, very effective about how do we keep people successfully aging at home? Because that's a big buzzword right now in the medical community and in a lot of communities. People want to be home. They don't want to go to the hospital. How do we do that? How do we support them to stay there and successfully age? And these are the mechanisms and the tools that we have that are already in existence. So we also have a unique program that we use for telemedicine. And we've teamed with this really cool company called Connected Home Living out of Palo Alto. And what we do that's a little bit different is every patient is given a iPad, basically, or a Samsung monitor, hooked to Bluetooth-enabled blood pressure cuff. It reads their oxygen levels and all that kind of stuff. And it relays that data through video chat. Now, the really cool thing is that what Connected Home Living does is it has non-clinical people who get to know these people and triage with them and spend time with them. And it's customizable. So they can call 6 times a day to check on Ethel. They can call Frank at 8 o'clock at night and say, did you remember to let the dog in? They, you know, did you take your medications? Those type of things. So we manage the clinical aspect of it. So if we see alerts like the blood pressure is too high or the oxygen level is too low or something, we step in and help cover the clinical part. But the really unique part of this is it develops that socialization. So I'll give you an example. We had this woman, we were actually helping take care of her up in Montana, and she would go to the emergency room 3 to 4 times a week. Literally 3 to 4 times a week in the emergency room. It got to the point where they would make a joke of it and they just alternated which hospital they brought her to because they knew there was never really a problem. She was lonely and she was morbidly obese and she couldn't leave the house. But she had these, if she called 911, she had these gorgeous fire guys who would come and pick her up and take her on a trip and all that. We started the telemedicine visit. Do you realize she didn't go to the ER for over 6 months? And the one time she went, it was because she literally needed help physically. That's the kind of isolation. Those are the kind of issues that we're dealing with. And this is a unique platform that hopefully we're going to see more and more of that. That it's blending the clinical with the non-clinical. Connected Home Living has also done is they took kids, high schoolers actually, started a volunteer program. So now the high schoolers were integrating through a video platform and taking them to their swim meets and taking them on a walk with their dog through the neighborhood and talking to Earl about, and he could recognize the neighborhood that he used to be able to walk himself. These are the kind of platforms that we're going to have to start to mobilize and look towards as a smart solution. We talk about that shortage of volunteers. I mean, we run the exact same problem. There's only so many bodies. We have more nonprofits per capita than anywhere else. So how do we leverage that? How do we smartly use our volunteers to their best efforts? So that's our telemedicine solution. We also, just 2 years ago, under my direction, we started a primary care practice because what I recognize being out in the community is just that. There is no primary care. So we have a house calls and facility-based primary care practice. It is a palliative focus, so we're very comfortable with having the dialogue about fulfilling the goals, whatever somebody's goals are, whether they want aggressive medical treatment or they don't. We will meet them where their goals are, and we adapt that dialogue as it goes. But this has been phenomenally successful. We have more and more patients entering that every day. On top of that, we are about to add mental health and counseling services to that because we recognize the need for that. We also will be able to do that through those same telemedicine platforms. So they'll be able to do telecounseling with these people as well as face-to-face. And then we do a boatload of community services, more than are even listed here, but these are some of our big ones. Caring Callers and Good Neighbor Program, we train people to literally just go into the home, do whatever they need, whether it's light housekeeping or trips to the store or just visitation and reading to them or whatever they need. Senior Peer Counseling is very unique and really kind of cool. What they do is seniors who volunteer are put through about a five-month training, very specific training, where they're trained as counselors to then go out to their peers and literally do counseling. So it's sort of a low-level mental health integration program. Very successful. We have great outcomes with that and a lot of success through that particular program. Mediation services is run through the county court system, and it's literally a free mediation program for the entire county. So anyone who wants to use it can use it for free. We get a lot of Cal Poly resolution disputes with neighbors through that. But something we're very proud of that's been growing every year. And then lastly, we do the full service partnership, which is through the county mental health. And we've basically taken on and we aggressively case manage their senior population of chronically mental ill. So we're talking the 67-year-old schizophrenic and who's had very mixed success with staying on their medications and their mental as well as their physical outcomes. We are able to get them housed. We're able to make sure they're taking medications. We get them to their doctor's appointments. But it's beyond that. They're taking them for groceries. They are on call 24/7. So we abate crisis early. We keep them out of the ERs. We keep them out of mental health. We keep them successful. That we've been doing for about 2-3 years. Fantastic program. We're hoping to build that out even a little bit more. One thing that's not up there, we also have a loaner closet that's free to the community. So as people have aged and they have bedside commodes and wheelchairs and the walkers that they don't use, we've been collecting all of that and we give it back to the community for free. So something else we've just started that we're very excited about. So I wanted to bring it back around, and actually it's fortuitous timing that Tracy gave her speech this morning about everything that's going on, because I really feel like now that this is my world is aging and all that, that I don't think we're doing enough to prep. And I don't want this to be another COVID-19 moment where 5 to 10 years from now, we're saying, oh my God, what do we do? You know, I thought we were ready. But guys, I'm seeing more and more of the 89-year-old lady who lives in a single wide trailer in one of those places in Pismo with no family, no support, and we're going in. I went into her home, and she has raccoons living under her couch, and she's eating food that expired 6 months ago, and she has mental issues, and nobody is supporting her. And the problem is there's nobody to support her. There's nothing we can do. We talk about housing. If you guys don't know the reality of it, to get caregiving in the home, so you can stay home, you're talking $15,000 to $25,000 a month. It's over $25, $25 to $30 an hour for a caregiver to be in the home with you. This is only for the wealthy. Or they're going to blow through everything they have in the first year. To go to an assisted living, you're talking for the dirt cheap place, $3,000 to $4,000 a month. That's more than a lot of people's Social Security check. The high-end ones are upwards of $15,000 a month to go into the really nice Taj Mahal places. So how are we going to really support these people as they age? It goes beyond the medications. It goes beyond everything else that we see on the surface. This pool is very deep. And so thank you for listening to me on my soapbox for a moment. I appreciate that. Questions, comments?
Well, I've been working in the outpatient physician world for 40 years, and I can give you some business educating and what have you. We need to have you out there with those, as you said, from your previous experience. When they come into so many of our clinics, we don't know what's going on at home, and they arrived at the clinic, we assume they had transportation to get there.
Right.
But as I was working in Detroit once, I remember we had a patient that lived in Ontario. It was my first day on the job. She actually had a cardiac arrest as I had her on the table doing EKG, but she had taken 6 buses. She had her husband who had Alzheimer's and couldn't leave him at home, so she had him with her. She had to go to the hospital, obviously. So we had the husband. Thank God the hospital agreed to give him a room for the night or whatever. But there's so much more that goes on with these older patients.
And speaking of that, the physician's offices are not trained as well as what are the community resources? What should we be referring them to? I've got them here. I see the need. What do I do?
They at least need to know what the starting point is and who they go to first and then where they can find the Tinas of the world or whatever, and the coordination can start to happen at that point. So, good. All right, other questions from commissioners? Or are we all too stunned?
Stunned? Sorry, I didn't scare you.
No, that's right. Candace, let's start down with you.
Thank you very, very much. I'm on your bandwagon. And, you know, I'm a native of Cambria. And so you want to talk about isolated seniors. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they just go home and disappear. And we've been trying to work with the churches. And the churches say, no, they disappear on us, too. And you can't keep track. So there's a lot of concern around that. We've got a couple of nonprofits up there that we're trying to see how we can work to do some of that advocacy with those seniors. So I really appreciate what you brought to us tonight and how well you've put this together. Because, I mean, you're hitting the points that are out there.
Well, and just speak to another point you just said really quickly, and that is that we have all these nonprofits, and people are trying to do well. We all have our little segments that we're doing great in. For example, we at Wilshire have done certain aspects. Dignity's got certain community-based services. Central Coast does a few. I mean, these are the agencies that are out there. And then on top of that, there's tons. But what I'd love to see is that somebody would spearhead, and no, I don't have the time, but to get all the nonprofits in a room to say, hey, by the way, I do this, and hey, I do this, and I do this, so I could look and say, oh my God, I need you. Because right now, I don't have a clue who's doing what. We're all vying for the same donor dollars, which is getting super hard because there's donor fatigue. We're all trying to get the same volunteers, and there's volunteer fatigue, and they're spread too thin. And I really feel like if the county is going to be successful about helping people stay here, people retire here, so we are where people come to age, we need to look with foresight about how we're going to support them and becoming almost like a clearinghouse in some way of who are all the agencies, and we wouldn't have redundancy in programs. Right? The worst thing we could do is, for example, Hospice Slow, I love those guys, and then they do a great job. But they have programs that are redundant with some of the ones that we do, which are sort of like, wait, stop spending money on that because we're already doing it. Like, spend the money on something else, and here's an idea of something else you could do. But nobody's pulling that all together into one big. There's a model out there called the village. Have you folks heard of this? Some of you are saying yes. We need a village. I mean, that's what's slow. We moved here to be in a small town, to age graciously together. We need a village. We've done that for some of the homeless kind of effect. We need to look at supporting our seniors in the same way. Because, guys, I am seeing bad stuff going on out there in the homes, but nobody knows it till we walk in. Sorry, soapbox again. Anyone else? I'm way over 15 minutes.
You kind of freaked me out. That was your intent. I'm part of the so-called sandwich generation, so I'm still raising my kids, but I brought my parents here a few years ago. Yes, right. So I see this approaching in my personal life as well as, you know, all around us. And I worry about access to care for everyone. And it also sounds like I can't solve all of those questions that you just freaked me out with, but it sounds like you would be a good place for volunteers as well. Would you take Cal Poly students?
Oh, I'd totally. Love Cal Poly students. Are you kidding?
So I have right now a psych major who wants to be a geriatric nurse practitioner and would be perfect. Like,
we
perfect.
Will get her so busy she won't have a clue which way's up.
I love it. So yeah.
I'm up here, Tina. You gotta
I have
wait.
More.
No, but seriously.
It's not unlimited, but we have a lot.
But, you know, there's programs out there like Adopt the Grandparent. There's people that just need help
right.
walking their dog. My son, you know, we live down by French Park, and we just discovered that there's a 97-year-old guy who lives around the corner from us with prostate cancer who just needed help walking his dog.
Right.
And we didn't even know it. He's four homes down from us. So you bet my kid's over there walking his dog all the time, but that's the village effect that I think we need to start percolating. And who's going to become the clearinghouse? You know, those Cal Poly kids, if you don't do it digitally, they're not even going to talk to you. So, you know, we have, I think through our Good Neighbors program, we have this, like, Craigslist, basically, of here's need. If you want the need, grab it and go.
Great.
And then but we aren't great about putting it out there. We've got to go to the next level, like go to Cal Poly and say, look, kids, you need to do some socially conscious stuff. Here's a whole list. Go clean out the garage. Go walk the dog. Help become that village.
Yeah, come to talk to our pre-med club. They'll be all over it. They really want that.
Mm.
Yeah.
My son's in that.
Yeah.
Nothing else?
I just want to say that we do have the Adult Services Policy Council. All the people get together and talk about what services they have, but not to the degree that you're talking about. Oh. So Wilshire actually does come, yes. And then when you look at Slow Village, they actually do have one here, and they're trying to really get started. So
it's new, isn't it? Just the past year.
Within the last 3 years, they really got.
So it's starting.
It's starting. I just want to let you
know. Got to get together.
Yes.
Thank you, Jean.
Thanks, Kevin. My question was around connected home living.
Yeah.
Can you speak about the successes and challenges of that technology piece that doesn't necessarily always blend as well as on paper? So I'm just thinking sort of the challenge of implementing that in the home.
So the challenge, the obvious one, would be the technology piece itself. Mm-hmm. The nice thing is that, and I foresaw that as a major challenge too, this, you know, you got a blood pressure cuff and this tablet. The nice thing is it's completely dumbed down software. So you have a tablet that has nothing but a green button that says connect. That's not hard. So we actually have been, and then it literally has a picture of the blood pressure cuff. It walks you through how to put it on. So it's comfortable enough, and it's geared towards people who are not tech savvy. So that particular hurdle, we were able to jump pretty easily. The successes are just phenomenal, not just, for example, that woman in Montana, but the patients that we're using it on, we went from a readmission rate, which is, you know, the bump back to the hospital, of about 17% to people using that are about 3%. Yeah, phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal success.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We had two great presentations this evening. So, and I think you both have Candace's contact information, and she will be supplying you with some volunteers for sure. Good. All right, thank you. Do we have any public comment on any of the speakers this evening? It is allowed, should you want to. Okay, thank you again for being with us this evening, all three of you. So before we go on to the public health officer report, we do have an agenda item this evening. It is the letter of support for the budget proposal for the California Wellness Fund. The letter is in your packet. Hopefully you all had a chance to read it. Any discussion?
No, I thought it was great. Yeah.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to go ahead and submit the letter if someone would like to do that.
Amy? I'd so move.
Oh, okay. Amy? One can do and one can second, whichever you want. Okay, we have a motion and a second to do a letter of support for the budget proposal for the California Wellness Trust. Let's do a vote, actually. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We will submit the letter of support. I will go ahead and sign it and get it off.
Thank you.
Okay.
Really, every voice and every sector from every part of California makes a difference, and SLOW is really well represented.
Good. Okay. Thank you. We will do that.
Well represented.
All right. So, Dr. Bornstein, what's been keeping you busy the last week or so?
Yeah, I'm still here and with you. And I actually was thinking that I was going to tell you I can only report on that which has occupied 100% of my time recently, but I will get to COVID. I decided I will add a couple of other mentions in my report. Based on what I was hearing, they are relevant. One of them is good news and one of them not so good news. So I think I had mentioned previously to your commission that we are in the health agency getting funding for a whole person care program. We've received the funding, we've received board approval, and we are now in the process of trying to fill a program manager position who will be the supreme healthcare navigator for vulnerable populations and working in close concert with our care coordination coalition. So I mentioned that to tell you what's going on in that program, but also to see if you all know the best person who can apply. That position, I think, is posted now on the county website for a program manager for healthcare navigation for to coordinate across these kinds of systems that we're talking about, homeless shelters, hospital, supportive care in the home, et cetera. Mental health, behavioral health. So the not so good news, we were disappointed, but not at all surprised. A very competitive grant that we submitted for Alzheimer's services, we did not get. Five jurisdictions were awarded. Four of them had populations approaching or above 2 million. And the fifth one that they picked, one small county and not us, I think was Sutter, Shasta County. But anyway, so we were disappointed. But once again, Slo County often suffers in these competitive grants. We thought we were really in this time because of our aging demographic. But they also were very much looking to health inequity issues. And yes, we have them. And that's why we are supporting a wellness trust, but apparently not as much as some other jurisdictions. So that was disappointing, as I said. So I will give you a brief update on COVID-19, coronavirus disease, and where we are in this county. I will not give you the global or national picture, but I will bring it down to home, what we're doing and what we're thinking. So we, as of today, still have zero cases in our community. There are, well, it was this morning, 114 cases in California. I'm sure that number is significantly higher now. Quite a bit of action across the entire U.S. It is only a matter of time that we will have cases locally. And we have committed to the community, the public, the media, that we will certainly let everybody know when we do have a first diagnosed case by laboratory. That said, it would not surprise me if we had the means to test everyone who's got mild respiratory illness that we, in fact, have cases and haven't yet identified them. But we are still in a somewhat restrictive, though less restrictive than it was initially, but still triaging every possible case for testing. And there's a number of reasons for that. So let me first say there's a bit of a mismatch between what is being said publicly by visible and well-meaning folks, be it our vice president or the governor of this state, that anyone who wants a test can get it, and what the reality is on the ground today. And this is going to change, but we in our county now have the capacity to change. We have the test kit. We have begun testing. We have twice today in media interviews, I told reporters, we are not going to test you. We are not going to tell you who we're testing, how many we're testing, because last week we got into a media storm of, oh my God, the first suspect case is here, and it turned out to be negative. So so our commitment is to tell people when we have cases. In the meantime, we're continuing to test people who meet criteria, which, again, as of today, I preface just about everything in this arena, which is as of today. We are emphasizing the CDC criteria, which is close contacts of a confirmed case, people who have come from or traveled from places with sustained transmission. Those include, in our world, the five countries that are designated on the CDC travel advisory of continuing to be China, but South Korea, Iran, Italy, and Japan. And it actually, the evolution over recent days is such that the United States is actually seeing in some areas sustained transmission, and that is just undoubtedly going to increase across the nation in the coming days to weeks. So we are also, when we are triaging these cases, we are taking particular looks at people who have come from Seattle. And as of today, we've added to our internal triaging considerations, including Bay Area and Los Angeles. and we may add New York soon. And very soon, I imagine, we will get to a place where geography ceases to make sense. But again, this is we are taking a very careful and data-based approach as we move forward in this. We also are continuing to focus on people who are hospitalized or have significant illness. And even when we are looking at people who aren't necessarily presenting for hospital care, we're looking to rule out other diseases first. And so that is the groups for whom we are prioritizing testing and from whom our first cases will come. Again, I want to emphasize that having said that, I suspect that there is a lot more illness that is out there potentially now as we speak in our community. So what are we doing to contain and or mitigate the spread of disease in our community? So I am of the mindset that we have that containment is a little bit of spitting in the wind at this point, that we really need to start pivoting to diagnosis, awareness of the level of and severity of spread amongst people in our community. And there's a wide variety of what you will hear publicly as to how bad this is, how easily it is spread. So I will tell you the Penny Borenstein well-researched data on this and is not necessarily the same of what you will hear out of the mouth of the WHO director, World Health Organization, is not necessarily what you're hearing out of our own federal government. But I think it is really important for us to use the best information that we can. And even as I say that, I recognize that there is very much uncertainty in anything that I can tell you, and yet I think it is critically important for us to find the balance between overreaction and underreaction. So, some of the best sources on this, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the national director at the National Institutes of Health of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He came out with a recent paper based on, I'm not going to go into the weeds on the data, but that our case fatality rate may well represent less than 1% of all cases. I do my own math on a daily basis, looking at countries that are more like us. So South Korea, which is second only to China in terms of the number of cases they have, their case fatality rate has been running about 0.6%. To put that in context, 3.4% is what it looks like globally. When you look at the maps and the number of cases, the pandemic to beat all pandemics, 1918 flu, was 2.5% case fatality rate. So on the one hand, this could be very bad, but I think that the reality is much closer to a really bad flu. And the reason I say that is because in countries where they have the opportunity to do extended surveillance, and we really feel, and they've had testing for a while, and a situation that's been going on for a while, that I think they are capturing more of the denominator, more people with mild illness. And thus, if you capture all the people who are sick, you can potentially get a more real picture of how severe the disease is in terms of fatalities. Also, some of the information that I really put my faith in is, so how easily spread is it? Because even if you only have a fatality rate of 1%, but everybody gets it, that's a really big number. So it's also really important to have an understanding of what is the likelihood of transmission to, what proportion of our population. And I've seen a variety of figures on this, but using the terminology of attack rate, so out of a whole population, what proportion are becoming sick in at least this first wave of spread is anywhere from 1 to 10%. So 10% is a big number. 1%, not so bad. If only 1% of our county got it, we're talking, you know, a couple of thousand cases, 80% of them mild disease. This is a disease we can manage. If it's on the higher end, it really pushes us to the brink. And yet, if you spread that disease transmission over weeks to potentially months, again, I feel that our community can manage this. You can all run me out of town if I'm wrong, but these are the facts that I am basing our county's response on. So what are we doing? A, we are, as I said, still being somewhat restrictive in testing, but very much looking forward to this week. And in fact, LabCorp, we can't quite get an absolute answer on this, but we believe that this week that private lab testing is really going to ramp up if it hasn't already started. And why that's important is because then public health doesn't have to be involved in every testing decision. And doctors can, with their patients and the laboratory, determine, you know, really ramp up testing. So we're very much looking forward to that. In terms of some of the other decision making, we've had lots of communication with all the big sectors of our community, be it business, university, Cal Poly, Cuesta, school system, our own county, making decisions about how we're going to manage a situation with lots of illness and lots of concern and lots of fear. We, at least again, thus far, I told you I will say that with pretty much every sentence. As of today, we are not looking to implement anything very prescriptive like we will close a school upon the first case or we will cancel all events in this county when we get two or more cases. We are working with our partners to continue to see what the information is that's evolving in other jurisdictions that are coming before us in terms of the severity and the rapidity of spread, and we'll make our decisions in consultation with the key partners in our community as we move forward in this outbreak. So my take-home message is I don't think you all need to go home and make sure you have 2 to 3 weeks' worth of supplies. I don't think our community is you know, that we will have such rates of illness that cause 40% of our population to be home such that we can't manage our critical infrastructure like law enforcement or water systems or the kinds of things that we've been planning for decades in terms of pandemic response for a disease that might result in that level of disease and severe disease that would lead us to have a real societal breakdown. My plan is to avoid that level of societal breakdown by imposing it on people without having the backup information that it's absolutely necessary. Now, having said that, it is still very important. This is a killer disease, and it is particularly hitting our vulnerable populations. So individuals who meet those higher-risk demographics, be it by virtue of age or medical condition, it is absolutely appropriate for them to be thinking about and taking measures having situational awareness of, should I go to that movie theater once it's widespread in our community? You know, am I going to go to, an event where lots of people are hugging and kissing and drinking out of same bottles or what have you? You know, maybe even they need to, in some circumstances, if we get a level of disease spread that is much more dramatic than I'm imagining, it may even need to take some leave if elderly folks or people with medical conditions in the workplace. So I think this needs to be a structured and a layered response depending on individual risk and not necessarily at the first sign of disease in our community do we shut down society as we know it. That's the Dr. Borenstein approach to what we're dealing with, and I have all manner of folks who are in disagreement contacting us and me on a daily basis. But I am taking every opportunity to try to get our messaging out. So I appreciate your being one venue in which we can have that dialogue.
And what's that website address, Penny? I was on it this morning. Actually, I found it fairly helpful.
There's ReadySlow.org. ReadySlow.org will get you a link to our public health department link. And on that link is a microsite that leads you right to CDC. So, but the reason we're telling everyone ReadySlow.org is that's an easy to remember one place to go. It will connect you to the best resources that are out there.
Good.
Have we seen any confirmed cases in neighboring counties?
Not yet. None of our geographically adjacent counties have yet reported a case, to the best of my knowledge. That may have changed today.
Mm-hmm. Where did we get our testing kits materials from?
The Centers for Disease Control. So okay. We are now, if you've heard on the news, that now 15 jurisdictions in the state of California can test. That includes 14 local public health department labs as well as the state lab. We were one of the later ones to receive our testing materials. We did toward the end of last week. There is a period of there's a process that we had to go through to test the test and validate it, and we have been able to test over the last couple of days.
So I recognize it's a terribly dynamic situation, and that doesn't even describe it, really. How many people can you test if you had to?
Yeah, so on any given day, probably about 20. In totality, based on what we have right now, we have, so people, have asked me, how many test kits do you have? So a test kit, we received one, allows for 300 specimens to be tested. And since each individual is going to have either two or three specimens, if we can get the third one, sputum, that gives us about 100 to 150 people that we can test initially. I have every confidence that when we run through those, that we have the ability to rapidly get more test kits as needed.
Every confidence that you can get more kits.
I believe that to be the case based on what the federal pipeline looks like.
The federal pipeline. Okay.
Of test kits.
Thank you. You mentioned a case fatality rate in South Korea, I think. Best figure currently is 0.1%?
No, 0.6%, I think it was today.
0.6. So that's like one.
So that is high for a flu. That is a really, really bad flu year. But it's orders of magnitude less than SARS was in 2003. By comparison, the biggest killer, Ebola, is a 67% case fatality rate. It also doesn't spread as far and wide as something like this can. So living within or under or well under a 1% case fatality rate, I believe, is something that our collective healthcare system can manage. Doesn't mean that they are not running a bit haywire as we speak, and that's even before having cases. I don't envision people dying outside of hospitals for want of a ventilator, for instance. Again, if this is on TV, you'll all quote me if I'm wrong. But that's where I am at based on what I believe to be up-to-the-minute information.
So 0.6 is about 1 out of 130 or something like that. What is our experience with the average influenza season?
Right. So a bad flu season that we had a couple of years ago was more like 0.2.
Mm-hmm. 0.2%.
Right. But does anyone remember that we had a really bad flu season 2 years ago? And did... Okay, so many of us remember, many of our colleagues and loved ones got sick, and I'm not in any way being dismissive of this situation in front of us. I'm not being cavalier that people will undoubtedly succumb to this illness, as they do to the tune of tens of thousands of people from influenza every year. And I'm not looking to make a comparison that, oh, well, we deal with flu and we have lots and lots of deaths, so what the heck? It is nothing of that sort. I take it very seriously. I really am concerned about our vulnerable populations. I just think it's really important for our community to understand the levels of emergency that we might be faced with.
Well, it's comforting that you're all over this, Penny.
Yeah,
it's nice to hear your presentation tonight.
It's me and a team of really incredible, hardworking people in our local public health department who are always behind the scenes and unsung heroes. Yeah. And it's not just us. I mean, I know the hospital staff. I know private, you know, outpatient physicians. I know the university. Mm-hmm. I know them, any manner of people, businesses. We're all grappling with being as ready as we can be and thinking intelligently and thoughtfully and in a caring way about how to deal with it. So I'm just sort of the tip of the iceberg, but there's a whole community of engaged and responsive people.
So thank you so much. I can say that in person now for all the work that you've been doing. I am a person that benefits from hearing about the planning quite a lot. Like, that lessens my anxiety so much around this, particularly with the older population. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the kind of outreach you've been doing towards, like, elder care places or residential facilities, things like that, for their planning.
So we've been trying to just get all the guidance out and information. My PIO, I didn't even realize it when we met on Friday, and she reported out to our group. We have CHADOC open, which is County Health Agency Department Operations Center, and there was a report that I had done 7 TV interviews last week. I use our media as one very important means. Meetings of this sort. We've had all manner of telephonic and in-person meetings, particularly with the higher risk community, largely through healthcare providers, but also long-term care facilities. And you are giving me thought that we need to be much more intentional with not just our SNFs, but other senior environments.
The other issue I'm concerned about, and I don't know, there's nothing we can do about it, I just guess I'm expressing concern, is spring break and the timing of spring break and all of our students leaving and traveling all around. Mm-hmm. And then coming back. That's not a question, I guess, but like,
yeah. No, I'm sure you thought of that too. I talked to Mr. Armstrong and others today on that very topic. They're you know, advising students to really think about where and how to spend their spring break, and upon return, what kind of, you know, watch can be put into place regarding individuals becoming sick after mm-hmm. they have potentially gone to areas of greater spread.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a good idea about, like, I know it should be milder if a person is younger and they're in good health. I've seen a lot of variation in how much those folks can transmit with mild disease.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of other things that I could say about this disease. Again, it's based on, to some extent, to be quite frank, I probably am cherry-picking the data a little bit. or a lot of it. I don't know. But so I think that is an important piece of data, that out of the first 55,000 cases in China, only 2.4% were in individuals under the age of 19, mm-hmm. and that continues to be observed in countries that have seen more recent cases, that it really isn't hitting children. And that's really good news, both because we love and care about our children, but also they typically are our greatest vector of spread. So that is really good news. It also doesn't seem to be affecting pregnant women in the same way. We always talk about vulnerable populations as the elderly, the very young, the medically compromised, and pregnant women. And so two out of the four of those seem to be relatively spared, which is the very young and pregnant women. So did I answer your question? I sort of lost track there.
I don't know if I had. Sorry. It was about transmissibility and mild disease.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. Yes. Yes. Also, it does seem to be the case that that the sicker the individual, the more likely they are to spread. There was one other thing I was thinking about. Okay, I'll come back to it.
Yeah. I mean, early on, they had said that there was some asymptomatic spread.
That was it. It was like, and there was one more thing I wanted to say, which is about asymptomatic. Again, the largest studies that have been now reported in the literature say if it occurs, asymptomatic transmission is rare.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? You know, with our senior population being one of those at-risk populations, I'm wondering if another place to go to reach them would be through the religious organizations.
Mm-hmm. We are absolutely reaching out there.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Good. And spring break, Candace. My grandson's in up near Sacramento. Their school closed this week, which they made it quickly their spring vacation. So nobody's going anyplace because nobody had planned anything for this coming week. So,
that's one way to handle it. You get spring break early. Yes. You're quarantined.
I know.
Sorry, I don't mean to be making jokes about this, but it's...
Jean.
I just want you to know, I did receive a phone call from the person from the Commission on Aging, and they would like a speaker. And they meet on the third Friday of the month. And so I said that I would contact them once we spoke.
Okay. Yeah, that might be a group that we really need to reach out to. I think today, Mike, in addition to his other two jobs, has now become our logistics chief in our CHADOC Incident Command Center. And he is handling, among other things, trying to route the requests for speakers, which are beginning to come fast and furiously. And we are absolutely not, we don't have the capacity to keep up, but we want to hit the right ones and or triage them in a way that makes sense. So,
good month. All right. excuse me. Health Commissioner updates, starting to my left.
No updates. I'll do it next week.
Good. Susan?
Yes, a couple of updates. Just to let you know, the first five are in the midst of their strategic planning. And for the HSOC, the county has applied to the state for, the HAP grant, which is last year they got this one-time funding to help ease the homeless situation. And this is a second year of that one-time funding. So we'll know more, and they'll know in April a lot more about it, so I'll be able to report then. And there is a new, with the homeless housing committee that meets, we heard about some other grants and state changes for additional dwelling units, tiny homes, those kinds of things. So a lot of this is coming up before the Board of Supervisors and City Councils, and it's a good opportunity to get to know some of the creative ways that they're trying to use existing houses, and conversion of garages is something they're talking about, just different things. And mm-hmm.
where you don't change a lot of the footprint, but you're able to provide some other housing. And there's also, I just went to one of the first meetings of the encampment committee, and they're looking to really kind of find some new solutions and some new ways to work with the folks that have created these encampments. And I know our program next month is on the Blue Bag group, and I'm hoping maybe we could also include a speaker from the new encampment committee for that.
Good idea. Do you have some kind of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Laurel Weir, and she
I
may not
Candace
be able to.
Candace is doing that program, so
oh, are you? Oh.
Hang a left there and talk
right.
to her.
Okay.
Jean?
Okay, I just want to report on Adult Services Policy Council. In February, they actually talked about the Advantage plans. So when you look at health care and what's available to seniors, it was nice seeing that they kind of explained what an Advantage plan was. Sometimes that does not happen. And this month, they were talking about the 2020 census, and also Joyce Ellen Lippman was talking about that. She might be someone else to talk to as far as how we can be supportive. Because she does have the ear of many agencies. And then the Commission on Aging, they had a February meeting, and they were talking about victim witnesses, you know, things that they were doing in our county. And the other thing is they were asking us to come and talk about, you know, what they should do as seniors with what's happening now in the environment. Amy?
I am reporting on the Heal Slow Healthy Communities February meeting. We had Chris Reed from the City of Slow present on the Slow City Climate Action Plan, which was really fascinating as it pertains to housing and building sustainable healthy environments and built environments in the county. One of their most cornerstones of the climate action plan was that they have one of the most aggressive climate action plans to become carbon neutral by 2035. And the city is leading by example to create a climate action plan specifically for the city to do that by 2030. And they're doing that with over the next several years through a strategic planning process that you can access at slowcity.org/sustainability. And they're also looking at how they can reduce those greenhouse emissions as a target goal to embed within the county as well.
Okay. Bob?
Well, finally, we have some good news on the Oceano Dunes dust issue. The most recent milestone that the APCD had set for state parks has been met without a lot of fuss, apparently. And that's a first. The APCD is requiring a more compressed timeline to deal with issues that they raise in the scientific advisory group. And it appears that State Parks is on board. As far as tobacco control and vaping, Mary Jean might have a better handle on this. I think, you know, in essence, communities, incorporated communities, are working on it pretty hard. The county, as we heard earlier, has passed a pretty restrictive ordinance for the unincorporated areas. And, you know, my nightmare is that there'll be a few incorporated cities that will become sort of the dope and vaping capitals of the county. And I think we really need to work toward a uniform approach for the county. But it's progress.
Good. Well, I think the Tobacco Coalition, they have a good strategy how they're going to reach out to now those communities
yeah.
that have a less restrictive ordinance and try to bring everybody more in line so that, you know, I have an ordinance in this city, but I can just go two streets over and I'm in a different city and we have nothing there. So I think we should be very proud of our tobacco coalition and the work that they have done in this county. They work very hard. And we have a member, Julie Albers, is in the audience tonight. She's the co-chair of the Tobacco Coalition now. But they work very hard, and they have some good successes with what they've done. So, good.
It's reassuring working with some of these county groups on issues like this. There are some terrific people working for us. And I always walk away, I shouldn't be surprised by it, but it's really impressive.
And I think we're fortunate in this county to have those. So, yes. And I actually have no update myself. The community-based organization, Preventive Health Grant Committee, the application has gone out. I think they're due by the end of March or so. We won't be starting to look at those grants until sometime early May, and then make the recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. How about any of our standing committees this evening? Legislative, Amy, is there anything?
Okay. I do. The first is a bill that was introduced on March 6th, so just a few days ago, Senate Bill 793. That is a bill that would prohibit tobacco retailers from selling and offering sale of possessing or intent to sale flavored tobacco to a person under the age of 21. Not inherently surprising, although the fine level is only $250 for each violation, so the bill itself is working to increase and compound on the fine each time per violation. Another bill of interest was introduced just a few days ago on the 5th. That is mental health services, grant dollars. That bill would require the Department of Rehabilitation to establish a grant program for local jurisdictions that are enforcing quality of life violations with the goal of diverting people who are experiencing homelessness away from the legal system and into mental health services. That is Senate Bill 1200, something interesting to track as well. That just came into introduction, so I should have an update, hopefully next meeting as well. Another is a bill that was introduced a few days ago on the 3rd, Senate Bill 1073, which is looking to align Medi-Cal and WIC eligibility to reduce barriers of eligibility. So those that also qualify for WIC also qualify for Medi-Cal, but they're working to establish express lane agencies so that you don't have to go multiple places, provide multiple documentation, so they can share records to increase their efficiency around that.
Would perhaps be like presumptive eligibility for OB services?
That would be the goal. I think there's a lot of inefficiencies with how eligibility works around them, so they're looking to sort of cohabilitate them under one entity or agency. More timely, COVID-19, as of yesterday, 114 cases. With the declaration of a state of emergency in California, there was a request for legislative dollars of $20 million for state government to respond to the spread of COVID-19, and then federally $8.3 billion in emergency funds to trickle down to FDA, CDC, National Institutes of Health, but also to respond to procuring vaccines and other medical supplies from the federal level.
Good. Thank you. You've been busy reading, girl. Any other, Jean, anything on the nominating committee? We sent the one recommendation off to the board as of tonight.
Well, I was asking around different agencies if there was anybody interested, you know, as far as a service provider. And it looks like we have a past Health Commission member who is interested, so we're encouraging her to submit an application. And then
I think we have it.
Oh, we do. That's wonderful.
We can agendize it next month, right, Mike?
Perfect.
Yes, we have the packet, and it will be part of the agenda item.
Okay. So we will still have one consumer seat open, correct? And Mike, you have put out the, what do you call it, the recruitment word or advertising?
We have advertised it in accordance with MATI Act, and we are also using our social media people to keep the word out about the openings.
Okay. Perfect. Good. It'll be nice to have a full commission sometime soon again. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else this evening before we adjourn? We will, prospective future items, I think we have our next few months planned. We'll have our planning meeting again in December to go for, or no, we already did December, right?
We actually had some in December that may move forward, so that's good.
So in June or July, we will have the next planning meeting. I'll get the act together here. So anything else from anybody before we adjourn this evening? If not, I'll entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Thank you. We are adjourned.